Welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Annie.
And I'm Dave. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, a TV show, or book we were a fan of before we were married and the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
So today we're doing the 1993 comedy film Cool Runnings. Why did you pick it?
So it's interesting because it's never actually been on the list. It's not something I've ever thought of as doing for the podcast. It wouldn't have occurred to me. But we went to a pub quiz with our friend Gavin, who was a guest star on the Gremlins episode.
And people will certainly remember that one.
Yes. I was not there. It is not my fault. But one of the answers to a pub quiz question at that quiz was Cool Runnings. And you said you'd never seen it. And I was like, oh, well, that would make a really good thing for the podcast then. And
cool.
So it kind of turned up on the list.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think overall?
I mean, it was fun. I mean, I don't think I was particularly the target audience for the film, which we might talk about in a bit.
You're always obsessed with target audiences, you.
And me, a little bit, yeah. I mean, I am a niche. I was going to say I am a niche demographic. I used to be a niche demographic 30 years ago, but then, you know, when Marvel became mainstream, I am the mainstream demographic now.
Well,
but,
yes.
Yeah, it was somewhat funny in places.
Okay.
What did you think?
Well, I enjoyed it. When I looked it up and it was 1993, it surprised me, so because I must have been at least 15 or 16 when I first saw it. And I assumed from my memories of it that I was much younger than that. So, yeah, that took me a bit by surprise. Yeah, I mean, it's very light. It's very silly. But it still got me in the end. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. How about a brief plot synopsis for anybody who has not seen it?
After failing to qualify to get to the Olympics for the 100-metre sprint, three Jamaican folks and their kooky friend find and pester a previous Olympic athlete who is also in Jamaica into coaching them to become Jamaica's first bobsleigh team.
Yes. And that is pretty much it.
That is pretty much it.
That is pretty much it.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to go for some facts?
Can do. It came out in 1993, which I thought was interesting because it feels very 80s.
It does feel very 80s. I had assumed that it was an 80s film. I mean, it's set in the 80s. Because it's the 88 Olympics, 88 Winter Olympics.
Right. I mean, as I will possibly come into more detail later on, it not only feels very 80s, it feels very MTV.
Oh, okay.
Which I'll come to later on. It was directed by John Turteltaub. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that properly. Who is best known for doing Nicolas Cage, National Treasures.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
That's his bag. The screenplay was a lot of people.
Yes, there were apparently a lot of script issues.
So a lot of people came in and out on the script. Very interestingly, it was going to be a straight drama.
Yeah,
not
sports drama.
Comedy originally.
Not a comedy, yeah, originally.
By a guy called Jeremiah Chechik, who, when him working on writing the script fell apart, left and instead wrote the script for Benny and June. Which I personally absolutely love.
Yes, yes. Good film. Very good film.
Yeah. I've just got a note that says the writing, directing and hiring of actors seems like a mess. From what I was reading in Wikipedia, they had various people that they were signing on at various different times. John Candy took a he's the only real actor in it of recognisability, I would say. He took a cut from what he would normally get paid to do it. Apparently, he was very keen to be involved in it.
It was his last film released in his lifetime.
Oh, okay. I feel very mean about the next thing I was going to say then.
Go on.
I feel like he really was just phoning it in.
But
Hans Zimmer, who is normally amazing, does the music, and the music is fine.
I don't think I even noticed any music at all, which is possibly a good thing, possibly not.
I mean, it's fine. It cost $17 million to make, but has made upwards of $160 million in the box office, so it's done very well. It's got 76% on Rotten Tomatoes and 60% on Metacritic, which is, you know, average above average.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to go into the facts of the true story at this point, or?
Well, we need to at some point.
Yeah.
I've got quite a lot of stuff written down about that. Do you want to go first?
Sure. Well, there was a Jamaican bobsled team in the 88 Olympics, but they mm-hmm. didn't stand out as much as the film suggests, because there were other teams from...
Tropical
nations, the Netherlands, Antilles, and also the US Virgin Islands, mm-hmm. who competed in the two-man event.
Yep.
And the Jamaican team also competed in the two-man event.
Mm-hmm.
There was, so at the end of the film, they're on their supposed final run
mm-hmm.
when they, and they're in contention for potentially getting a medal, and they crash and then have the heroic carrying the bobsled over the line mm-hmm. while everybody's cheering at them. And the crash is real, to the extent that real footage of the crash was used in the film, though heavily edited.
See, I thought that was interesting because I could tell immediately something to do with the film quality or something.
Yeah, it was different.
When they cut to the crash, I went, wow, that's actually the real footage as soon as I saw it.
And it was their penultimate run, and they were very much not in contention for a medal.
Sadly not.
They didn't carry the sled over the line, they just walked next to it. But, I mean, I just think it's absolutely amazing that nobody was killed in that crash, to be fair. So the fact that they managed to walk away from it,
mm-hmm.
excellent. So it's obviously been blown out of proportion and changed for dramatic purposes in the way of a lot of films to make it into a better story.
So there's some other little bits about that. So there's a bit in the film where they are disqualified for late entry. That actually happened. So they were disqualified for late entry, and then lots of people, including other bobsled teams.
In the film, they're disqualified because the evil coach guy who has a vendetta against John Candy's character says they've changed the rules to make... Because the teams have to have taken part in an international race in order to qualify to be in the Olympics.
Right.
And previous to that, the tryouts for the qualifiers for the Olympics counted, and they decided to make that not the case.
Right.
Whereas in real life, they were disqualified for late entry.
Okay, so but they were so the in the 1988 Winter Olympics, the Jamaican team was disqualified for late entry, and then after lots of people spoke up, including other bobsled teams, they were allowed to compete. They unfortunately came last.
Yep.
There's a bit in here that I've lifted from somewhere. They said the whole idea for the bobsled team came from George Fitch, who was the commercial attaché of the American Embassy in Kingston, after seeing a pushcart derby. Now, the film starts
with a pushcart derby.
Yep. Which is kind of like a souped-up downhill
go-kart
thing, which is a thing that's big in the States, I think. And so he suggested it, and the president of the Jamaican Olympic Association was totally on board, which he is not in the film.
No, he very much not.
Very much shown as being, you know, you're just going to make us look foolish. And I think that's mean, because in the real world, he was like, yeah, this is a great idea, we should do it. But they've portrayed him as being, you know, one of the, if not bad guys, then people who were...
I wouldn't class him as a bad guy.
No, I think that's too strong. But,
yeah,
you know, but he's not...
class him as a, I'm concerned that this is going to go awry and reflect badly on our country
mm-hmm.
while everybody else is pissing themselves laughing at them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I sympathised with him to a certain extent.
Yeah, me too. The other thing in this is that when they were trying to recruit, and they put lots of things up and went up to like athletics teams and stuff and said, do you want to come and be part of our bobsleigh team? Everyone was like, we've seen videos of people doing this. There's no flipping way I'm getting in the bobsleigh and going down a thing. So they went to the Jamaican Defence Force, which is the army, and looked for people who were nuts, basically.
Okay.
And recruited three people out of the army to come and do it. So the main lead character, who's shown as being in the film as being the son of a previous Olympic boxer?
No, he was 200 metres.
200 metre sprinter. Yeah, he's in the real world. He's like a colonel in the army and stuff. But he's you know, he wrote a quite popular book about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And does talks about.
So in the real in real life, it was the coach guy, the American coach guy, who came up with the idea and recruited them.
So it doesn't mention anything. I haven't read anything about coaches.
Okay.
The idea came from the commercial attaché of the American Embassy.
Sorry, you did say that.
But I don't. It doesn't mention coaches at all, really. So I don't know if John Candy's character is real in any way.
Okay, probably not.
They probably just
because I remembered him being at the Olympic trials and recruiting them there, and it being his idea. When in fact he's given up on the whole thing and been out of the sport for nearly 20 years, and it's Dorice, the sprinter guy, whose Olympic dreams are dashed when he is tripped over in the qualifiers, who goes and harangues John Candy's character about it. And I had not remembered that that was the case.
We should probably talk about the characters a little bit in a moment, just so people have a nice idea what we're talking about. But before we do that, can I just briefly go back to what you were saying about both qualifying and whether or not the people in Jamaica thought that they were going to be making a fool of them.
Okay.
Because I want to talk specifically about Eddie the Eagle briefly.
Okay.
So Eddie the Eagle, presumably most people have heard of him, is a British ski jumper who qualified for, I'm not sure, but one of the Winter Olympics. Came last by a very long way, but was extremely popular both with the other Olympians and with people around the world. But what happened after... it was Calgary, so it was the same one. I'm reading in my notes now. But afterwards, the Olympics have changed their requirements, saying it's almost impossible for anybody who is not manifestly of Olympic standard to go and compete now. They've instituted what has unofficially become known as the Eddie the Eagle rule, which requires all Olympic hopefuls to compete in a number of international events and be placed in the top 30% of a minimum of 50 top competitors for a certain period of time.
Okay.
So,
well, that kind of makes sense.
So what it means is that if the reality was portrayed as the film, which is that they just rock up in Calgary and John Candy just wanders over to the stand where there's a thing which has basically got form saying, fill in if you want to take part in the Olympics.
That's not what it says. He goes up and he says, I'm here to register a bobsled team. And the guy looks it up in the computer and has all the information there already. So all of the paperwork has been done and they have been accepted to take part in the qualifiers because he knows when their test run is.
So,
but I take your point.
Yeah, but it would be very significantly harder for a team or an individual to compete now unless they've demonstrated over a significant period of time that they are one of the best athletes in the world.
Right, that so you can't get starry-eyed hopefuls just turning up on the off chance.
Yep.
Okay.
Right.
So we could just run through the main characters.
Oh, that'd be really good, yes.
So it's quite interesting because they are called Bannock, Brenner, Bevel, Blitzer, and Coffee.
Sounds like reindeer.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? So they're all B names. But yeah, so John Candy is he was on the US bobsled team.
No, he was
16 years previously.
He was a boxer, wasn't he?
No. Yeah. Otherwise, that wouldn't be the whole thing with him knowing how to do bobsledding.
That's not an unreasonable point. Okay, somehow I've misheard that during the thing.
Okay. Sorry. And he got two gold medals and then at the Olympics, the 16 years previous to this one, put weights in the front of the bobsled to make it go faster and was disqualified and had his medals stripped from him.
And presumably all his teammates' medals stripped from them as well then.
Well, presumably it's why they hate him so much.
Yes.
So he is Irv Blitzer. And then the bobsled team is Dorice Bannock, who, as we said, is the son of a previous Olympian who was intending to qualify for the 100 metres.
So he can do the 100 metres in 10 seconds flat.
9.9.
Which, you know, at some point in time was unbelievably fast. I don't know around the late 80s, because I'm trying to think of who the sprinter was who got the world record and was then disqualified for drugs. I can't remember his name, but I'm sure that he was well under that by then. But I don't know what the slowest speed at the 100 metres in the Olympics would be, so I don't know if that was a genuine qualifying thing, but it's interesting. I don't know how many rounds of qualifying things happen for all of the different events in the Olympics, because on TV you only tend to see the finals for things.
Yeah.
But it may well be that there's like 10 rounds at the background with people from all over the world doing other stuff. I've often, but just to, you know, because this is what we do, just to go off topic slightly for a second, but I've often wondered what it must be like if you are the, I don't know, 13th or 14th fastest 100 meter sprinter in the world, because you're still spending all of your time training. You're a professional athlete, you do this all of the time, but no one's ever going to know who you are, and you're never going to be in the final for, you know, any international competition.
Yeah,
but
it's
you
true.
Know, you're still slogging your guts out. And I guess it's, you know, being in the, you know, outside the top 10 but inside the top 20 for anything at international competition level, where, you know, you're just working really hard all the time. I suppose depending on where you are, you're probably the best in your country, I guess. So it just depends on what
you're
at. But yeah.
Anyway, so we've got Irv Blitzer, the coach, Dries Bannock, the guy who recruits everybody and decides that it must be a fantastic idea, and his friend Sankar Coffey, who is the, what's it called, the car thing driver,
pushcart driver,
and the comedy relief.
He is kooky,
but you know, he comes into his own. And the other two that they end up recruiting were also trying to qualify for the 100 metres. And Junior Bevel, who is from a rich family in Kingston, was in between Dries and the other guy, whose name, weirdly, is Yul Brynner. And I don't really know why.
Mm-hmm.
And he fell over and tripped both of them up, which is why none of them managed to make it. And they are the other two. And the arc of enemies to friends between Junior and Yul Brynner is my favourite aspect of the whole film.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I was kind of shipping them, I have to say.
Really?
Well, there was kissing. Yul Brynner kisses Junior on the forehead. But anyway,
okay.
That's just me.
Apparently.
Yes, so that's the five. And that's basically, apart from the bad guys, who all of the characters that are in it.
Yeah, I mean, the bad guys aren't...
Stereotypical but... German bad guys.
Yeah, they're not really in it very much.
And the guy who was previously Blitzer's coach, who has a vendetta against him and tries to get them disqualified.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's basically it.
Yes. I don't really have anything to say about about the cast, apart from the fact that, I mean, I'm feeling very mean because I've never really been a fan of John Candy. I mean, I can't...
No, me neither.
It's not really my kind of humour.
This is a relatively... He didn't straight role for him, relatively.
Didn't seem like...
It's fairly subdued.
He was making a lot of effort, as far as I could tell.
His speech when he went into the meeting and argued for them to be re-qualified again was pretty good.
Yeah, I guess.
So what do you want to talk about?
Well, let's pick a thing at random. So it felt... I don't know if this is a definition that I am just making up on the spot, quite possibly, but it felt quite like what I would call MTV-esque humour. I think it's worth pointing out that there's a six-year run of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and this is right in the middle.
Okay.
And so I wonder whether that is the target audience they're trying to hit.
Well, it's fairly mainstream, surely.
Yeah, but it's skews much younger than maybe might be expected for a sports film.
True. Well, I mean, there's like stuff like The Mighty Ducks and...
Oh, yes, true.
But then that actually is kids in the film.
Yep.
So, I don't know. Yes, as I say, it surprised me that I must have been at least 15 when I first saw it, because I assumed that I was like 11, 10 or 11.
Because there's a lot of comedy falling down.
Well, yes and no.
There's quite a lot of comedy falling down.
Okay.
There's
quite a lot of comedy crashing into things.
There's...
And when they obviously they first go on the ice, they all fall down, but then they would.
There's a bit where they're in Jamaica and they're trying to recruit and they're showing a bobsleigh film where the lights go down and the room is full of people and the lights go up again and there's everyone's gone.
Yeah.
Which is a kid's comedy trope.
Yes. Very silly.
There's a comedy dog briefly, although I can't remember where he is. I've just written down a comedy dog.
Don't even remember a comedy dog.
Oh.
Don't remember a dog at all.
He must have been in the bit in Jamaica at the start. There's the fairly standard trope of rich kid stands up to his dad.
Yeah.
Which is...
I mean, it's all very stereotypical.
It's but that is often a kind of... I don't know how well that character is supposed to be, Junior's supposed to be.
Mm.
But, you know, it's portrayed as normally middle teens, upper teens kind of rebellion kind of thing. And so it fits in with, the, I think, aimed at the lower, so earlier demographic.
Okay.
So I just... I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying I think it's aimed at early teens, that kind of age, which is why I feel a little mean saying that, you know, it's all a bit average, because I don't think it's aimed at me. And so, you know.
Okay.
So I thought the timing was very confusing.
How so?
So they were trying to qualify for the Olympics for the 100 metres.
Yeah, which would be the Summer Olympics.
Yes. And then when they failed to do that, they got in the bobsleigh and went to the Winter Olympics.
And when they first approached...
Which would be a minimum of 2 years later.
Well, it depends on... Yes, I did wonder about that, because when they finally persuaded him, I don't know how long it took them to persuade him, he said, you haven't got time.
I'm just saying, for future Annie's understanding, I'm checking whether there was a weirdness and the Summer Olympics were actually the same. Yeah, carry on.
So, I don't... Yes, it is confusing, because I don't know how long between the qualifier in Jamaica and the actual Olympics in terms of training and team building and whatever. And I also don't know in the film how long it was between them first having the idea. I don't know how long it was between first having the idea and persuading John Candy's character to do it, at which point he then says, well, there isn't time because there's only 3 months.
So I take it all back. I have just Googled, and for some weird reason that I haven't checked into the details of, in 1988 the Summer Olympics and the Winter Olympics took place in the same year.
Okay, which well, there is you go.
Very unusual, because normally they are 2 years out, they're every 4 years and they're 2 years out of sync.
Yes, well that's what I thought too. Okay, well so that explains the timing then.
That is really confusing. They rock up in Calgary and seem to not only have time to basically learn how to bobsleigh, because they've never really got in a bobsleigh before.
Yeah, not a real one. Yeah. Certainly not on ice.
Yeah.
So, it's all very ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So they have enough time, as I've got written down, to do a training montage.
I think there were 3 training montages.
Are there?
Ooh, yeah.
Montage. My favourite bit in the training montage part was when the four of them are sitting in a bath and going 1, 2, 3 left, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 right, and then learning the corners.
Yeah, turns on the track. That was very good.
I really liked that. That was great. We could talk briefly about the bad guy.
Which one?
The German.
Okay. Because he's not really... All he does is kind of sneer at them and heckle.
Which I want to
start... The real bad guy is the US coach, actually actively... combats them being in the thing at all.
So the first thing I was going to say is that real Olympians don't do that.
They
don't like mock each other and have a go. I can't imagine that would ever be the case.
No.
We're just having a mean German because we can. And then later there's I can't remember what he says, but there's a bar fight, which, you know, would have them all excluded if it was in the real world. And as soon as this starts, I'm like, oh, they've only included him so we can go through a slightly tropey cycle of he's mean and then they have a fight. And then after the fight, there can be, you know, buddies and he can support them and say yay afterwards. I think that
No, happens. That only happens right at the end. They earn his respect after actually doing a decent run and then crashing and insisting on carrying the bobsled over the finish line. And that's when he joins in. He starts the clapping.
Oh, okay. Because what I thought it was there's often, especially in American films, a trope of people who disrespect or don't like each other coming together after they've had some kind of violent contretemps.
Yes, that is true.
And it's like, violence brings people together.
Yeah.
It just seems to be a, you know, general tropey thing for sometimes in the States. So,
well, the overall message kind of shifted quite dramatically, because to begin with it was, if you work hard enough, you can achieve your dreams. And then suddenly, just before the climax, it's, but you have to have something outside your passion, otherwise it can lead to obsession and then bad things. If you're not enough without the gold medal, you'll never be enough with it. And so then it's okay that they don't actually get a medal, which would have been completely ridiculous anyway. So it kind of shifts completely of, you must follow your dreams and work as hard as you possibly can to do it, but not so much that you go over the top and don't actually have a life and be a real person.
So there has to be, I mean, we're kind of jumping to the end and then I might go back and do some other things, if that's all right. But there has to be some reasoning within the narrative of the film as to why they're not going to win. So a sports film, either, normally, correct me if I'm wrong, has, you know, the plucky underdogs come through and win the day and it's amazing, or the plucky underdogs come through and get all the way to the final and then come second and it's still fine because it's okay to not win all the time. And when we've shown that in the film, unlike in the real world, it's looking like after their first run in which they are all over the place, later on it's like it turns out that because they're Olympic class sprinters and, you know, they've
managed to pull it together.
What do you call it? You know, full parts, clear eyes, can't lose, whatever it is. Kind of thing, you know, that the commentators start wearing, you know, t-shirts with their stuff on and it's like they might get a medal, and it's like we need to come up with a reason as to why it's all not gonna work, because otherwise it would be too far from the real world.
Yes, well, the fact that they were possibly in medal contention was completely ridiculous, even within the sphere of the movie. They did tweak that from the real life.
So we get a bit of a speech about how it's okay not to, you know,
the real treasure everything. Was the friends we made along the way.
A little bit, yes. And then, folks haven't seen the film, what happens at the end is they don't fail, they have a mechanical failure in their sled box.
Yes, whereas the crash in the real world was determined as due to driver inexperience.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I've got in bold on my notes here that I really, really want to pick up is, one of the things that really impressed me in the film is that there's lots of bits where, so the crash is real, it's used from real footage from what happened at Calgary, but there's lots of other bits during the film where they've got shots of people in a bobsleigh going down a track and doing badly. So either going too high up or bouncing off the sides or, you know, this kind of stuff. They've got some...
What, in the film that he shows at the recruitment?
No. In the film. So in the film, you've got some runs of them going down the track. So the first run they do at Calgary, the first time they run to the Olympics, they do badly because they're bouncing off the sides and not doing very well. In the making of the film, they must have got some real bobsled people because stunt people aren't going to have the skills to be able to do a bobsled. So they've got some real bobsled people and said, we want to film you doing really badly and bouncing off the sides.
Which must be really hard to do that without actually being dangerous.
So the two things for that. First of all, if you're really good, how difficult is it to do it badly? And second of all, just seems incredibly dangerous.
Yes.
And so, you know, major props to the people who were doing that effective stunt work who aren't stunt people, because they must be professional bobsleigh people because they're the people who know how to do it. So I was very impressed by the, as in so many things, doing something badly under control is often harder than doing it well if you're
professional. Absolutely.
So
it's funny, I just suddenly thought maybe they did it really slowly and then sped it up.
But you can't.
You wouldn't be able to. But then it reminded me of the bit in the middle when Dorice is watching. He gets obsessed with the Swiss team and how fantastic they are.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he watches them do a run, and it shows it being done in slow motion with him kind of like watching all goggle-eyed. But actually watching the sled run in slow motion just makes it look really boring.
Okay.
So it's meant to be more dramatic, but it's actually way less.
Yeah, I've written down that what are we, as the audience, supposed to take away from the film if the position that they achieved at the end was neither the, you know, plucky underdogs win the thing or come second or whatever, but a kind of... The level they achieved at the end was entirely out of their control. Because it was down to mechanical failure. So it's not like you can say, you know, it's great they've won, or they tried as hard as they could and then they came second, because they tried but they weren't quite good enough, and that's okay. It's like they tried as hard as they could, but then are we supposed to think they would have got a medal if they hadn't had the mechanical failure? Or are we supposed to...
No, we're supposed to appreciate that they reacted to their defeat with honour and, you know, insisted on completing the race because it was important to them.
I guess. It just feels like any kind of agency that they had in the level of how well they did in the big run at the end of the film was taken away.
But they'd already managed that with the previous one, which made the people respect their ability because they showed that they could do it really well.
Yeah, I guess. Okay.
Because if they'd just done the crap one and then crashed, everybody would have still been laughing at them.
Yeah, yeah, I see that's what you're saying. Just for another thing, so when they get there, John Candy's character blags a broken down practice sled off some random guy that he knows. And then when they come to do the final runs, it's got a shiny...
Well, they painted it.
Did they?
Yeah, it's the same one.
Oh.
It shows them painting it and putting Jamaica on it and putting it in the colours.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't do that to begin with, but I guess it made it more dramatic that they had that for the actual competition.
Proper bodysuits and helmets, which I think it's implied John Candy had shelled out the money himself. I don't know how...
Yeah, quite, I don't know where he got them
at the start of the film. He's shown betting on something and then smashing up a radio with a poor cue when he didn't win. So I've got some other small bits. I'm intrigued by this notion of people coming to the Olympics for qualifying things, because if people qualify, it implies that other people don't qualify, because that's what qualifiers are.
Yeah.
And I'm just intrigued that if these people who had never got into a bobsled before they arrived in Calgary qualified, who was supposed to be worse that didn't get through?
Yeah, I think those are the kind of questions that you don't ask. Because surely the qualifiers would have been held beforehand.
Well,
in some way, like the qualifiers for the the team in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, there was one very specific thing that I wanted to mention, which is that they arrived in Calgary and they are in the airport, and John Candy walks out of the airport and the airport door opens and they're facing, you know, the ice and snow that's outside because it's minus whatever it is. And they all just stand there going, even though they've been trying to cold acclimatize themselves by... Sitting
in an ice cream truck.
Sitting in the back of an ice delivery truck. Not like an ice cream truck, but like a truck that delivers ice. But they're doing the, you don't want to go outside. Reminded me very strongly, but flipped the other way round, of my first trip to Florida.
Oh, yeah. First time you walk out of the airport.
Because the door opens and I walked outside and just turned around and went back and outside and went, nope. Absolutely not. It's like, you know, 95% and 100% humidity. I'm not going out there.
Yes.
So that was quite amusing. I wanted to mention specifically a bit about Jamaica.
Okay.
And I don't really know how to talk about it. I thought it was interesting that at the bit where you said you'd been obsessed by the
Swiss team.
The Swiss team. To the point where when they were starting their run, one of them, they were counting in German before they went down the thing.
Because they were copying the Swiss team.
And that didn't work for them, and it became a whole thing about, you know, you have to be...
Find your own style.
You have to be true to yourself. And so they rocked up the next day in what is, we are presumably... asked to imagine, is a typical Jamaican, everything's going to be fine, kind of laid back, walking with your arms flopping about kind of way.
Okay.
And, well, this is my point. My point is that I don't know, because I'm nowhere near this kind of culture, I don't know how realistic that was and whether that was just, you know, over-the-top caricaturing of what, you know, Jamaicans are really like. So...
Well, there is a whole thing about the presentation of Jamaica and the attitudes. And I was wondering when the Olympic committee guy says, I'm not going to support you creating a Jamaican bobsled team because everyone's just going to laugh at us. And I wrote down, isn't the film laughing at Jamaicans? But I don't think so. I mean, it is to a certain extent, but not in that way and not wholly, because it has a lot of heart to it too. And in fact, it's Sanka, the comedy character, who actually brings the team together and makes the argument about finding their own style that enables them to achieve their dreams anyway. And none of them are, you know, completely the butt of all the jokes.
So I really don't think it's making Jamaica or Jamaicans the root of the comedy. I don't think you're laughing at Jamaica at any point. But I do think that their portrayal of Jamaica is not necessarily accurate.
But are an awful lot of Jamaicans who laugh at them being Jamaicans wanting to be in a bobsled team.
It's true. Yeah.
In the montage where they're trying to get the money and they're going to all the different places asking for sponsorship.
I found it particularly amusing. Sorry, I'm so terrible with names. The main...
Dorice.
I thought when they turned up to do the last run and they were, you know, we're being our own style, doing our own thing, and Dorice was all kind of, you know, I'm sort of mellow and you know, relaxed and stuff. That's not him in
I mean, they turned up on the truck singing their song, but yeah. I don't remember being different in any way other than that.
He always seemed quite uptight to me all the way through, and then, you know, when he's suddenly doing, you know, the singing on the back of a truck at the end of the thing just does not seem like him at all, but still, whatever. But there were a couple of specific lines that I wanted to pull out. I can't remember. I think there's a bit where Yul Brynner, no one knows why he has this name in the film, not related to the real person.
Yeah, it's very, not. Everybody stares at him when he says that's his name, but nobody asks and it's never discussed.
So he's the kind of mean...
He's the angry one.
You know, don't touch me! He wants to punch people all the time. And so his desperate thing is to get away from Jamaica and get off the island. And his pairing is with Junior, who's the son of the rich guy. And the rich guy, first of all, Junior doesn't tell him that he's going, and then his father finds out, and then his father sends him a thing saying, come back home, because you're just embarrassing us, and he says no, and then his father rocks up in Calgary, and then he has a whole thing with him where he says, you know, I'm a grown man, I can do whatever I want, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And there is no coming together at the end, the father just goes.
He's in the crowd. When they're walking the bobsled over the line, he's in the crowd and he opens his jacket and shows that he's wearing a Jamaica team t-shirt.
Oh, I completely missed that.
Yeah.
Wow. Many things I've missed in this film.
Yes.
But there's a confrontation between Junior and Yul Brynner, which comes just after Yul Brynner's like, I'm going to get off the island. You guys are all going to be, you know, rubbish stuck on the island forever, which seems to be implying that some people who live in Jamaica think that Jamaica is really bad and they just want to get away.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's the case with a lot of places. There's probably an awful lot of people who don't like the town they came from and look down on the people who always stay there. True.
And Yul Brynner says, I'm going to, you know, be famous.
Make something of myself, yeah.
I'm going to be famous and I'm going to live here. And he pulls a photo out and it's the
Buckingham Palace.
It's Buckingham Palace and they all laugh at him. But there's a line where, and I can't remember who says it to who, but he says, you're going to end up as an outhouse shanty dock worker like everybody else. And then Junior has a whole thing where he says, well, my father started out in a one-room house with absolutely nothing and now has this, you know, great big mansion.
Yeah, he's got one of the biggest houses in Kingston.
And this whole thing. And I appreciate the rags to riches story, but it's this implication that most people live in a shanty and work in the dock, which may or may not be true, I don't know, but it's just this kind of implication that that is what Jamaica is like.
And using
that as a kind of thing to say all Jamaicans are, you know, living in shanty huts kind of stuff. And they obviously show his father living in a fancy house, but it's a stereotype that...
Oh, well, there's a huge number of stereotypes in this film, but yes, I take your point.
Mm-hmm. There's another line that says, and again, I can't remember who said it to, I didn't write it down, it says, the more people like him that there are in the world, the better the world will be, especially for Jamaicans. Which again seems to be implying that your average Jamaican is either lazy or not, you know, making an effort to better themselves in some kind of way.
Maybe.
It just felt that there was a little bit of a dig going on. But I don't really know.
Okay.
I'm not sure I have anything else before we get to diversity.
Okay. So there's an unfortunate moment where John Candy comes to them after the bar fight and he says he's told the bar owner that they're all mentally disturbed so he won't press charges.
Yes, that's not great. Yes,
not great.
I have got that written down.
And in terms of women, the first line of dialogue in the whole film is by an older Jamaican lady who is objectifying Doris for having a nice arse when he's wearing.
Okay.
So also not great, but flip of normal. But otherwise, there is only basically one female character who is Doris's girlfriend, and she doesn't even get a name.
No, she gets like three or four lines. There's a woman behind a bar in Jamaica, because they cut back to people in Jamaica watching them competing on TV.
Yeah.
And, you know, also doesn't get a name and doesn't really get any lines. There's basically no women in it.
No, basically no. And that was about it, really.
Women, there is one good part.
Oh, go
because
on.
Yul Brynner, they're relatively near the start of the film. They're trying to collect enough money to get to go to the Olympics.
Mm.
And...
Oh, yeah.
So the kooky one...
Sanka
is singing in the street and getting no money. And Doris is trying to get money off the Olympic people, I think.
Yeah, and banks and places, but also... charging people for kisses, which his girlfriend doesn't like.
Oh, yes, that's right. And then...
Yul Brynner's doing arm wrestling.
Yes.
And gets beaten by a very impressive young woman.
Yes, so there are lots of big men, and he just, like, beats them really quickly.
Yes.
And this woman comes up, and she's like, thump, and he's like, oh.
Yes, that was quite good.
So that was quite amusing. Yeah, I mean, the only... specific race-related things is a line that John Candy says, I think, to one of the Olympic people about, you just don't like four black guys in a sled.
Yeah.
He says at some point to one of the Olympic officials.
And there is, you could argue, because he goes in and makes his impassioned speech about how they've done everything that's been asked of them and that the only reason that they're getting any pushback is because of him and his history with the sport, and that they should be allowed to... they've earned the right to represent their country and they should be allowed to compete, whatever, and it's kind of like white saviour.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, a little bit.
But it's got a lot of heart.
Yeah.
And I think overall the Jamaican characters are well presented.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a range of them. They're not all the same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they come through and win the respect of the community.
Mm-hmm.
The Olympic bobsled community.
And in the real world, the Jamaicans have carried on competing in the bobsled.
Okay, fair enough. But yes, I think that about wraps it up for this month's discussion. So it's time for the ratings. We use a standard 5-star rating system with half stars allowed. Dave, what is your rating for Cool Runnings?
I think it's a pretty solid 3. I think it's a good average. There were 2 or 3 bits where I... genuinely laughed out loud. I thought mm-hmm. it was really funny. And there's nothing wrong with it in any way. It's absolutely fine.
Fair enough.
How about yourself?
I'm going to go 3.5 because...
I nearly went 3.5, but
oh, okay.
I didn't quite.
It made me cry at the end when they were carrying the bobsled over the last few feet and everybody was cheering. I liked it. And I really enjoyed the arc of Yul Brynner and Junior when Junior defends Yul Brynner's dream of getting away from Jamaica and making something of himself and living in Buckingham Palace. And he stops the others from laughing at him. And then Yul Brynner helps him with his self-confidence and standing up to his dad. And I thought it was really sweet.
Mm. Yeah. Did you still love it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot, actually.
Okay.
So, what are we doing next month?
exasperated sigh there is because you already know what we're doing next month. Yes,
true. You're revealing how the sausage is made. We've given ourselves extra time because...
because we're doing something that we haven't done for a long time. We're doing a book.
And a proper book. Not that kids' books aren't proper books, but you know what I mean. Mm. An actual longish book.
Because we've been doing quite a lot of relatively lightweight stuff like this or Gremlins recently, I thought we would do a radical change and go back to maybe what we did earlier on in the podcast and do something that's a bit more deep and serious. When I discovered that Annie, shockingly through school, had managed to escape reading To Kill a Mockingbird.
We didn't do anything American in school.
By Harper Lee. So we're doing that for next time.
Yes, when you said, I can't do the, I was going to pretend to do the reaction, but now you've revealed that I already know. I was unimpressed because it's like when my dad picked Catcher in the Rye for Family Book Club, and I was like, I have been avoiding this book for 30 years. I've been avoiding To Kill a Mockingbird for 30 years. I've just, for some reason, never wanted to read it, so.
Okay, well, we shall see what you have to say.
We shall see.
And that's it for this month's episode of We Still Love It Tomorrow. Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell us about a time you shared some media you love and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can email us at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And remember, you can buy our merch at bit.ly/loveittomorrowpodcast, where hyphens when spaces should be. And finally, please join us next month to find out what Annie thinks of To Kill a Mockingbird.
And whether or not Dave still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.